From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The question lingers like a lazy lob over the red clay of Roland Garros. Why can't the U.S. develop more top-ranked male tennis players? Ahead on Only a Game, we'll hear from some former number one U.S. men. Also, an exploration of sports blogs and their responsibility, or lack thereof, to tell the truth. And a conversation with Franz Lids, author of Fairway to Hell. Also ahead, Texas Hold'em pencil necks get a good working over at poker boot camp.
Some of the things I learned today really pointed out to me, oh boy, did you make some mistakes. If I had taken this course before I made the final table at the World Poker Tour last month, I probably would have fared a lot better than fourth.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Last night, the Boston Celtics took Game 6 of the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals, defeating the Detroit Pistons in Auburn Hills, Michigan. Boston advances to the NBA Finals, where they will meet the Los Angeles Lakers. Game 1 is scheduled for Thursday night in Boston. Loud rejoicing could be heard from the general vicinity of New York, where one can find the headquarters of the NBA. It would have been unreasonable to assume when the 2008 Major League Baseball season began that at the end of May, the Tampa Bay Rays and the Florida Marlins would be leading their divisions. Joining me now to help explain why the owner of the Yankees, whom Tim Kirkchen has always maintained are still the Yankees, recently demanded that his employees begin playing more like the Rays is the very Tim Kirkchen to whom I just alluded. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here, Bill.
The Tampa Bay Rays sit atop the American League East. The Rays have always had great individual players on teams that were usually collectively very bad. What has allowed them to turn it around in 2008?
Well, a couple things, Bill. Their starting pitching is demonstrably better than it has ever been in the history of the franchise. Now they have three, maybe four, quality major league pitchers in their rotation. Other years they had maybe one. Plus, they've got young kids in their starting lineup that can really play, and they're just so tired of losing that when they see that, hey, we're not so bad after all, then their confidence really starts to grow.
The Rays also have the number one pick in next week's Major League Baseball draft. Is Tampa Bay permanently through with bedevilment courtesy of their AL East rivals?
I think so, and I think it's changed the whole dynamic of the division. The Yankees used to get back on track by going into Baltimore and crushing the Orioles. Well, that doesn't happen all the time anymore. And they used to routinely go play the Rays and pound them and get back on top. Well, that's not going to happen anymore because these teams are so much better. And, Bill, trust me, we're going to have this conversation 3 years from now, and you're going to be saying, very seriously, are the Rays the best team in baseball? It's not out of the question because they have stockpiled young players all throughout their system.
Tim, on Wednesday, the Royals lost their 10th game in a row, sparking something of a clubhouse insurrection, but Royals outfielder Jose Guillen quelled that uprising, right?
You know, Jose Guillen is a very difficult guy to deal with for most people. But I can tell you this, knowing him fairly well. He only cares about winning, and his team is terrible right now. He is disgusted with the way the team is playing. And as he always does, he lashes out, usually at an inopportune time, usually in a very clumsy way. But his heart's in the right place, and ultimately, he's right. There's a reason why the Royals have been really bad for well over 10 years, because they don't play very well, and the attitude there, even though it's being fixed, still isn't completely fixed.
The Texas Rangers are hovering around 500, but outfielder Josh Hamilton has given fans something to look forward to, right?
Bill, this guy is a great, great story. I mean, number one pick in the country several years ago, went off the deep end to the point where he's a drug addict, to the point where he couldn't even play baseball for 3 years, and now he's back, and his talent level is extraordinarily high. I sat with a scout at spring training this year, and we watched Josh Hamilton get three more hits, which he did like every day this spring. And I said, you know, that guy reminds me of Larry Walker. And the scout looked at me and said, oh, he's better than Larry Walker. I want you to go look at Larry Walker's numbers someday. They were pretty darn good. He was a heck of a player. And this scout just dismissed Larry Walker to me in favor of Josh Hamilton. That's how talented that kid is.
In the National League, the New York Mets were in the news this week, but not for the best of reasons.
Yeah, the Mets are a real mess right now, Bill. They have major clubhouse issues, meaning there's a real divide in there between the Latin players and the non-Latin players. And the non-Latin guys are basically saying, look, we're tired of being the only ones in front of our lockers after games. Now, it certainly is a communication issue, but it's much bigger than that, and it's gotten Willie Randolph in some serious trouble. And then for Willie, who played the race card last week, saying, or 2 weeks ago, hey, the reason we're not, you know, I'm not respected here, it might be a race thing. Of course, he apologized the next day, but it really caused a whole bunch of trouble in New York. And if the Mets don't turn around quickly here, Willie Randolph is going to be out of a job. My guess is there's too much talent there. They are going to turn it around, and they're going to at least be in it towards the end.
The Mets National League East rivals, the Florida Marlins, are making those who called for the dissolution of that team take back their words, given the 2008 success of the Marlins and the Rays. What do you think? Is it safe to say Florida pro baseball is there to stay?
The Marlins are going to stick around. They're trying to get a new ballpark, and it appears they're going to get one. It's going to be several more years, and you never know with Florida and a new park because they've tried so hard and failed so many times. But they are another shocking team at the top, because they don't have a good defensive team. Their pitching is just average, but they swing it so well. They hit so many home runs, and they have so many young guys in that room who don't even know what's going on, except we're going to go out and play hard. They played in one of those throwback games against the Cardinals, and there was a Gibson jersey, number 45 for the Cardinals. And one of the Marlins said, "Is that Kirk Gibson?" And they had to explain, "No, that's not Kirk Gibson. That's Bob Gibson. He played 20 years earlier, and he was a pitcher."
Not a bad one, too.
Yeah, it's a pretty darn good one.
Tim, you predicted at the start of the regular season that the Cubs would be a contender, and so far, you're right. What
Hooray,
the heck went wrong?
I got one thing right so far. This is really good. I'm doing well even by my standards. The Cubs are good, Bill. And given that the National League is not very good right now, which is not necessarily a bad thing, this could be the year that the Cubs get back to the World Series. They haven't been there since 1945. They haven't won since 1908. I mean, this is, you know, baseball is a very symmetrical sport. All these amazing coincidences come up in baseball more so than any other sport. And I think if the baseball gods are watching, they'll say, all right, this is the Cubs' year. The Red Sox won a few years ago. 100 years on the button, this is the year the Cubs win.
The Arizona Diamondbacks are also enjoying early success. To what extent are they doing that with the help of slugger Micah Owings?
You know, I never saw Red Ruffing, and I never saw Wes Farrell and those guys pitch from 60 years ago, but I'm telling you, this is the best hitting pitcher I've ever seen. He had a pinch hit home run the other day, which hadn't happened in 20 years. A pinch hitter in between his starts comes into a game and hits a home run as a pitcher. That's how good he is. And interestingly, he doesn't train for hitting like most everyday players. He doesn't take as much BP. He just goes up there and hacks, and he can really swing the bat. If you didn't know he was a pitcher, you would swear he was an everyday player.
Tim Kirkchin covers baseball for ESPN. He joins me from time to time here on Only a Game. Tim, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
The French Open tennis tournament got underway on Monday. As is often the case, when a major tournament is in progress, some fans of the game in this country are pining for the days when the U.S. had the number one male player in the world. The top U.S. men, Andy Roddick and James Blake, are currently ranked 6th and 8th, respectively. Admirable, certainly, but people do not dream on 6 and 8. McEnroe, they think, and Courier and Sampras, those were the days. Jim Courier, who was number one in the world for parts of 1992 and 1993, says some of the U.S. players who've made it to the top think about the current situation, too.
I think that is a big topic of conversation for us. I think that we all recognize the genius of Roger Federer right now and how challenging that is for everybody in the men's game who's trying to get to number one. And obviously, as Americans, we would love to see another one of us reach the pinnacle, and hopefully it will at some point. But for now, Federer's been too tough.
John McEnroe, himself number one in 1980 and from 1981 through 1984, has gone beyond hoping. He's suggested to the U.S. Tennis Association a plan to remedy the situation.
And I've long pushed for the idea of a tennis academy at the National Tennis Center, a real vibrant tennis academy. I've called it the John McEnroe Tennis Academy or Tennis Center because I believe that I could inspire the kids in a way that I was inspired in when I was younger. And I think kids need that, especially with all the choices out there.
The choices include other sports, of course. More and more children are specializing in more and more sports at earlier and earlier ages. But is collecting promising young and very young athletes into a tennis center where they could be inspired necessarily the way to develop a number one player? Pete Sampras, who was number one in the world from 1993 until 1998, doesn't think so.
It's an individual sport, and what I did on my own. I didn't have really any USGA help. I didn't go to Ball Terry's. Like, I just kind of did on my own. I was a little bit of fortune in that, a little bit of luck. But I can't pinpoint one thing why there's not a number one American in the world, and it just sort of goes in cycles.
Nick Bollettieri, founder of the Florida Academy to which Pete Sampras did not move, begs to differ. He claims he's got the numbers to prove that working with kids who leave home to concentrate on tennis at his academy produces results, though he acknowledges the competition is tougher these days.
Back in the 80s and the early 90s, the United States was the leader. I had 27 people in the main draw at the U.S. Open, and Curry was one of them with Agassi and Hasselish and everybody else. However, the rest of the world has caught up with us, and not only in tennis, but it caught up with us in basketball and soccer and golf and every other sport.
Bollettieri's recipe for success is to get tennis rackets into the hands of 5- and 6-year-olds, work on the fundamentals with those children until they're 12 or 13, and then funnel them into increasingly competitive situations where they will, in his words, beat the crap out of each other and reach their potential. He feels having the number one male player in the world would provide a significant catalyst to the growth of the game in the U.S.
Number ones and number two should be an inspiration to everybody. But when you have somebody from your country, I believe that's the way that's got to be. I don't believe that a champion from Ethiopia is going to inspire our kids to go out and be tennis players. I believe the influence has got to come from where you are, where you're born, and everything else. That's my opinion.
John McEnroe, who played high school soccer and basketball and considers himself better for the experience, might argue with Nick Bollettieri's theories about immersion in tennis. Come to think of it, current number one Roger Federer attributes his excellent footwork to his experience as a young soccer player. And Pete Sampras, he says he's less concerned about the citizenship of the number one male player in the world than he is delighted by the quality of play evident when Roger Federer defends his spot atop the ranking.
I'm a big fan of Roger. I'm a big fan of Roddick and Blake. I think they're great players, but you know, Roger certainly has a certain class about him that's incredible. He's a great player. I love watching Nadal, sort of tenacious, and he's a great competitor. So I'm a tennis fan, but just being around the sport and seeing the big picture, I think the media and the fans, they want to see that U.S. Open winner be an American. It's just tough. They're playing against one of the best players of all time.
Sounds a little like what tennis fans everywhere but the U.S. might have been saying to themselves and each other from 1993 until 1998, when Pete Sampras himself relinquished the number one spot. It's 19 minutes past the hour. If your plan is to set the world free fall record by jumping out of a balloon from a height of 130,000 feet, when that balloon starts up, you'll want to be aboard. That was the flaw in skydiver Michael Fournier's plan. The $200,000 balloon that was critical to his audacious scheme left without him. Fournier, a former paratrooper with more than 8,000 jumps to his credit, would have been jumping from an altitude 3 times higher than the cruising altitude of a commercial jetliner, except that the balloon drifted away without the capsule in which Fournier was waiting to ascend. Observers reported that Mr. Fournier was disappointed. They may also have wondered why nobody thought to include a bit of string in the plan. We can sing a song and sail along. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Franz Liszt's sometimes dissonant ode to golf. But first, to what extent should the people blogging about sports be subject to the same guidelines which bind people writing about games and athletes in newspapers and magazines or on websites like ESPN and Sports Illustrated? That question came up this week when attorneys representing Los Angeles Lakers star Kobe Bryant moved to get the proprietors of TheDirty.com to stop circulating rumors about their client. Joining me now on the line is Nick Ritchie, resident blogger at TheDirty.com. Nick, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me.
And we're joined also by Buzz Bissinger, veteran sports writer and author of Friday Night Lights, among other books. Buzz, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Bill. How have you been?
Very well. Thank
Good.
You. Nick, let's start with you. Last Tuesday, you wrote, and I'm quoting now, "Strong, dirty army intel just came in about Kobe Bryant and Vanessa Curry. His wife's last name isn't Curry. Uh-oh." What evidence did you have for that original accusation?
Well, what happened was I actually had a source that came forward to me who was trying to sell the story about 30 days ago. At the beginning, I wasn't really interested just because it's not really our realm of what we do at TheDirty.com. We're really more about gossip and satire and athletes primarily we really don't focus on. We sat down with the source and we fact-checked as much as we can. With stories like this, I bring in more of a staff of people because I'm not really an investigative journalist. I'm just a blogger, and that's what I do. The website's more for people to escape from their daily routine and have a laugh. It's not anything that's supposed to be too serious. But when stories like this come about, we really try to do our homework and put it out there. I haven't really put out the details of the story, and I think that's why people are really getting concerned about it.
Buzz, we brought you into this conversation because you recently railed against sports bloggers on television. You've backed off some of your previous statements after reading a few sports blogs which you found to be thoughtful and well-written. Is TheDirty.com among them?
Well, TheDirty.com is not among the blog sites that I regularly look at, although I've looked at it knowing that I would be on the show. I won't say I've backed down from my statements. I have backed down from the use of profanity and acting like a crazy Tasmanian devil. But I won't back down from my original statements. Yes, there are a few blogs out there that are, I think, dedicated to information, particularly blogs dedicated to covering a single team.
Mm-hmm.
But this story, I mean, Nick, I don't know where you're coming from. I mean, you know, if you put a story, first of all, I don't think it's anyone's business. I think you're only doing it for the sake of gossip. And the problem with your blog, the way it reads, is where's it coming from? I couldn't tell. Do you have pictures? You intimated that maybe you do. But even if you do, you know, what happens is you put it out on the blog. And actually, what I think is even worse, it hasn't really hit the mainstream media, but it did hit the USA Today blog. And I think that's disgraceful on their part. So rumor repeats rumor, repeats rumor, repeats rumor. Maybe it is fact. But, you know, the world and the wacky, wonderful world of the Internet, it suddenly goes around the world. And, you know, blogs may not like this, but you guys are part of the media and really part of the mainstream media. You're not nearly as counterculture as you think, and I think you guys have to have the same standards as newspapers do. And with what you reported, there isn't a single newspaper in the world that would print that story.
Well, Nick, at the risk of promoting TheDirty.com, is there more? You know, are you holding stuff back and there will be more to the story as you produce it?
Yeah, I actually put up a post last night saying I'm going to post everything that I got, all my facts and all my sources. How our site reads, and I don't know if Buzz saw the disclaimer, it's on every page, TheDirty.com is all about gossip and satire. The content that is published contains rumors, speculations, assumptions, opinions, and factual information.
What possible value does it have? I mean, it seems to me that you should put a disclaimer, so this site is ridiculous and dedicated to totally to gossip that may or may not be true. You put this thing out as fact, and when the heat goes on,
let's
behind the facts, hey, we're just having fun. It is the exact same stuff that Will Leach did.
Let's try and pull this a little bit back to the topic. In the past, some of our most accomplished athletes have been flawed, obviously. Muhammad Ali had numerous affairs. Babe Ruth suffered from an STD. The newspapers at the time called it a head cold. Why do we need to know, though, what an athlete has done, whether he's cheated on his wife, something like that?
Okay, well, people people like to read stuff like this. If you look at the news, you look at CNN, you look at the polygamy thing, you look at Nancy Grace, you look at O'Reilly Factor, you know, people want to see people get to the highest point. They want to see him fall. Something like this, you know, it was more for the girl. The girl was 18 years old, okay? She was forced to resign from the Lakers, okay? She's 18 years old to go follow her so-called hosting career, as the Laker organization put it. Okay, and I, like I said, I sat on this story. This isn't something that I just got. I had this story for like 30 days, and I didn't go forward with it until the girl got kicked off the team, and I felt for her. And unfortunately, Buzz doesn't like the whole cult thing of the blogs and the whole thing.
I don't believe a word of what you're saying. You put it on the site because it would create attention for your site. I did look at the original post. I saw all the cheesecake shots of this poor Vanessa Curry that suddenly you feel sorry for. Obviously, if Kobe Bryant was not involved, you wouldn't do it.
She took
the shot. Who cares if he's unfaithful? What does it have to do with anything? I know what it has to do with. It has to do with the gutter of our culture.
Buzz, let me pick up on something you've said and see if we can move it along. A lot of traditional sports journalists have been accused of burying stories about rumors and off-field scandals because they're worried about having their credentials revoked. Bloggers generally don't have that conflict. Is that necessarily a good or a bad thing?
Well, I mean, it is a bad thing if a newspaper reporter is holding back something of, for instance, someone who he knows, is using steroids, or there's an assault complaint been filed that has been filed with the police, and he's burying it, then he has been derelict in doing his job. The problem with most bloggers is that bloggers hide behind everything, and they say, you know, we sort of want credentials, but we really don't, because credentials will emasculate us and will become part of the mainstream. But it really gives them a license to say whatever the hell they want without, I think, anything close to journalistic standards.
Okay, Nick, let me ask you to pick up on one thing that Buzz has just said. Bloggers aren't worried about losing access. They don't have access. They're not in the press box. They don't have to deal with the team in order to get to the players. So what does keep bloggers from posting stories that may be untrue?
Well, you have to understand, the blogging community is totally different. Every blog is different. There's entertainment blogs. There's sports blogs. I never went out and said that I'm, you know, a great investigative journalist. That's not what I do. It's for entertainment value. My blog is supposed to be for fun.
Mm-hmm.
Buzz, unfortunately, is not our demo. Buzz and I, you know, we agree to disagree. It's just bottom line what it is. You know, if he wants to be the Darth Vader, the guy that wants to fight the blog community, that's fine. But I think he's learned from his first go-round. It's really an uphill battle.
You really pissed me off because, you know, I just bought a BlackBerry Curve. So how VHS can I be, man?
Well,
I just bought a BlackBerry Curve, for God's
well,
sake.
You got to understand, I'm of the younger cult. You know, I think I'm Blu-ray. You know, I'm not. I don't even think I'm DVD. But so my next story here, how about this? I have a slew of MLB baseball players that are paying for escorts. And I actually have actual checks that these guys used with their names on it to pay in the dollar amounts of that. Is that a story? Or
so what? I don't care. If you have baseball players paying these escort girls to get them steroids, story. If you have baseball players paying escort girls because they want sex, no story. I don't care, but I'm VHS, man. So,
well,
you know,
and that's the thing.
You know, let you little Blu-rayers go at it.
I'm gonna suggest that you talk to each other on your own phone line. I'm just going to sign us out, okay? Buzz Bissinger is a veteran sports journalist and the author of Friday Night Lights. Buzz, thanks very much for joining me.
Okay, Bill.
And Nick Ritchie is the resident blogger at TheDirty.com. Nick, thanks.
Hey, Buzz, it was a pleasure. Bill, thanks for having me, and stay you.
Golf can be tense. Ask anybody who's ever stood over a 4-foot downhill putt with money on the line. Golf can be gratifying. Ask anybody who's strolled down the middle of a June bright fairway following a 300-yard drive. Golf can also include llamas, and it can be naked. Ask Franz Lids, the author of Fairway to Hell. That's what I'm going to do now as Franz Lids joins me from WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell me about the nudist golf tournament that you attended, but don't tell me too much.
Well, my wife had suggested that I do a story on a nudist colony. So I Googled golf courses and nudism, and I found this one south of Kissimmee, Florida. For some reason, the longer I was there, the more and more layers of clothing I found myself putting on. Everything that was said was either a double entendre or possibly even a single entendre, going from the golfer's swing to their shafts to their strokes, and
it just gets worse and worse, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
Would you please read the opening sentences of chapter 14?
Yes, I will. It's here it goes. Jim Reed doesn't wear his bulletproof vest to bed anymore, but he still keeps a Bowie knife hidden in his boot, a Colt 45 stashed in his Corvette, and a 9mm Beretta concealed somewhere on his body. I prefer the 9mm Beretta to my 380 Beretta, Reed says. The 9mm holds 16 bullets. The 380 only holds 13. In my line of work, you can never be too sure.
And that line of work would be?
For a living, he finds and sells golf balls that have been hit into ponds and into the woods all over golf courses in Florida.
So this is the kind of line of work that you need to defend yourself? You have to be heavily armed to participate in this line of work? This seems quite unlikely to me.
Yes, there are all kinds of scavengers on golf courses, and you've got to defend yourself and protect your turf. That's the important thing. Even where there isn't turf, you've got to protect, you know, the muck.
This might be the appropriate time for you to tell the story presented in chapter 16 of how golf saved your life.
Well, when I was in college, I was actually in, well, it was the Andes, come to think of it, and I was on one of these buses which were packed kind of like the stateroom in Night at the Opera, the Marx Brothers film. And there would be, I don't know, 55 people packed in a bus that was meant to seat 32. I was on this bus. It was really a one-lane road, and there were two buses vying for passengers along this road. I'm not quite sure where the passengers were standing, because if you, in this case, you know, the side of the road was about 1 foot wide and about 8,000 feet down. And this guy started trying to pass the bus in front of us. Of course, there's no lane to pass in. All of a sudden, he pulls on the gear shift, and it came off in his hand. So we're flying along this road, and I thought that was the end. And this woman sitting next to me, who's just packed to the gills with you know, paraphernalia and pots and pans, she pulls out a putter, handed it to the bus driver very nonchalantly. He jammed it into where the gear shift once was and just went into third, and we roared into home. So that's how golf saved my life. Yeah.
You maintain that the toughest course in the world is the Konkola Golf Club in Zambia. What makes that course so tough?
Well, you know, there are 15 holes that are guarded by live crocodiles. There's a rogue hippo that if you don't watch your back, you're liable to be steamrollered by this thing.
And, plus, you have to play out of his footprints sometimes.
Yes, it says on the scorecard that if you land in a hippo footprint, you get a free drop. You know, even in the 19th hole, the clubhouse, they actually have insect larvae as the snacks. So it's a very exotic course in every respect.
So that was harder than playing golf among the ice floes in Alaska?
Well, it was certainly more challenging. With Konkola, in the old days, when a golfer would knock a ball or shank one into the drink, he'd send in his caddy, give him the equivalent of maybe a penny or something, to go fetch the ball, and the caddy would come out maybe 10 or 15 pounds lighter, missing various body parts. That, I think, is a greater hazard than playing, as I did with my daughter Daisy, in Alaska, where we're just sort of whacking balls off glaciers.
I'm talking with Franz Lids, author of Fairway to Hell. You're listening to Only a Game. I suppose for fans of hard rock music, you should explain the origin of the title of this collection of essays.
Yeah, it's called Fairway to Hell. I went down to Biloxi, and I heard that Judas Priest, the old British heavy metal band, was down there, and that the two lead guitarists were golf nuts. So I kind of met them on the course, and they were completely a blotto from a night of rock and revelry. And but at the same time, they were wearing polo shirts and chinos, and they had foot joys on, and they would gently tamp their divots back. The funny thing was that word had gotten out that they were on the course. These 14 and 15-year-old kids, most of them in dog collars, were hiding behind trees, were walking off the course, and one of these 14-year-old kids, they're all boys, by the way, yell out, "Y'all Judas?" And one of the players said, "No, he's among the disciples behind us." It was that was a lot of fun, actually.
I've read the book carefully enough so that I think I know the answer to my final question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you like golf?
Well, when I was growing up, the only person I knew who played golf was a father of a friend of mine who is this self-inflated gas bag of a dry cleaner. And I tended to think of golf as this kind of mirthless, staid, just self-absorbed game. And I was just trying to find somebody or characters or situations that lent themselves to fun or humor or something different than the Tiger Inc. mentality that the Pro Golf Tour has right now. My problem was years ago I read a quote by Jack Renner, who was then a PGA player, and he said his whole aim was to go through 18 holes without ever changing his expression. And I said, this is a terrible sport. But I actually, searching around, found people who got some enjoyment out of the game.
Franz Liszt is the author of Fairway to Hell, Around the World in 18 Holes. It's published by ESPN Books, and he joined me from WHYY in Philadelphia. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thanks a lot.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In an event some have called the United Kingdom's most bizarre sporting challenge, a great many people, caked in filth, tumbled down a steep hill in Gloucestershire in pursuit of a giant rolling cheese. Cheese pursuers came from as far away as Australia, New Zealand, and Japan to participate in the event, which is pretty much always won by the giant runaway wheel of cheese. This time around, wet weather rendered the course treacherous, though even under better conditions, many of the competitors would certainly have gone sprawling. More than 30 volunteers from St. John Ambulance handled 19 lads who were injured as they tumbled 200 meters down a steep hill. The cheese, although muddy, did not require medical attention. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, learning how to shut up and deal, and stuff that's even harder. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Los Angeles Lakers advanced the NBA Finals by virtue of their 100-92 defeat of San Antonio on Thursday night. It seems like just yesterday that Kobe Bryant was expressing his extreme dissatisfaction over his team's direction, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, then they redirected themselves and brought in some new players, particularly Pau Gasol, and became probably the best team in the league. San Antonio, we should bid adieu to, I'm afraid, because this particular bunch of Spurs looked like they were that one big step over the hill. When they needed to match the Laker intensity, they couldn't do it.
Just 2 days before they were sent home by Los Angeles, the Spurs extended head coach Greg Popovich's contract through 2012. I wonder if they should have waited until the playoffs were over.
No, he's done wonderful things for that franchise. He's an idol in San Antonio. He's probably a pretty good guy to hand over the rebuilding to.
On Wednesday, the NBA admitted that Lakers guard Derek Fisher should have been called for a foul at the end of Game 4 of that series. Were you surprised by the league's candor?
No, because it cost them nothing. Yeah, we screwed up. Sorry, play on. Sorry about that. You can believe your own lying eyes, folks.
Aren't they supposed to defend the officials no matter
what? Well, no, sometimes you have to throw them out the window.
The NBA also announced this week that flopping will not pay. In fact, it will cost players who flop. Good policy?
Well, first of all, Manu Ginobili will be broke by the middle of February. Second of all, I blame many things in professional sports. I blame soccer for this. I believe the influx of the Europeans who were taught soccer at an early age and taught the instinctive technique of flopping have simply adapted it to basketball.
All right. How can you be taught something that's instinctive?
What? Because every European, every person who is directed towards soccer has a gene for flopping, but it has to be developed. It's what we call a gene of predilection rather than a determinative gene.
I knew last week when you were kind to soccer that something like this was coming this week.
No, this has been a real problem. Seriously, this has been a real problem in the NBA playoffs.
Without a doubt.
And there have been some really obvious ones. And the better, I think one of the things this is a result of high definition television. Because the better you can see on the slow motion replays and the more detailed they are, the more you see some of these are just ridiculous. I mean, Manu Ginobili will not dry off until 2015.
The NHL Stanley Cup Finals are underway with the Detroit Red Wings up 2-1 over the Pittsburgh Penguins. Do you think the league is happy Detroit didn't take the first three games?
Yeah, because they wouldn't have gotten the two-goal performance for Sidney Crosby, who is the reason why people are watching the Stanley Cup playoffs this year a little bit more than they were before. I think that if you want to show people how to guard people in hockey, show them the first two games of this series where Detroit completely took Evgeny Malkin out of the series.
Game one, which was broadcast on the much-maligned Versus Network, drew an amazing 2.3 million viewers, Charlie. So is our long continental cauchemar over? That means nightmare in French.
Well, that's true, except the two teams are Detroit and Pittsburgh.
They all held back. You say the fans.
I think you've got Sidney Crosby. I think there's a player people actually want to see who don't like hockey. And that, I think that's the reason why the ratings are up.
James Blake, gone. Andy Roddick,
gone!
Never there. Yesterday, Serena Williams was bounced. Americans have not fared well at this year's French Open so far. Time to dig up the clay?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, once again, I'm going to get my annual storm of emails when I point out that this is the least significant and most freakishly unlikable of the four major tournaments in either golf or tennis, and I include the PGA, which is probably less significant but is far less freakish. They might as well play this thing on chicken salad. It's the province of Brazilian astronauts and Balkan teenagers, and I don't give a damn about it.
This is great because you get the email from golfers who are upset as well, you know, two for one. Tiger Woods is limping around and trying to convince people that he will play in the U.S. Open in a couple of weeks, but, well, he can beat anybody playing on one leg anyway, right?
Well, we're going to see, aren't we? I mean, this has all of a sudden become kind of a thing. You know, people in golf are starting to whisper a little bit. This is another operation on a bad knee. It's a little bit, people are beginning to wonder if it's chronic. But judging by his track record, he's probably going to come out and shoot 51 the first day of the Open.
The official guide for assistance at this summer's Beijing Olympic Games includes a section on how to help disabled visitors, but disabled people worldwide have not exactly taken to the language there, have
they? Well, I don't know if this is just bad translation or what, but the official guide for Chinese volunteers says under the heading of Skills for Helping the Disabled, they can be stubborn and controlling, defensive, and have a strong sense of inferiority. Do not use cripple or lame, even if you are just joking. Why would you use them if you were being serious?
This is most mysterious to me. On Thursday, Diamondbacks pitcher Randy Johnson struck out 9 batters and drew even with Roger Clemens for career strikeouts. So, does he catch Nolan Ryan?
Absolutely not. He's almost 1,000 behind, which should give you an indication of how far Nolan Ryan threw this record ahead of everybody else. It's another little sparkling thing for the lapel when he finally goes to Cooperstown.
And I suppose it encourages Clemens to seek reemployment.
Oh, no, 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 no. No, we don't even mention that. No, no.
For the love of all things holy, why, oh, why can't NASCAR get beyond wing mount violations?
Because if your wing mount has ever been violated, you'd know that it's a hard thing to get beyond. The Haas CNC Racing teams, that's Scott Riggs and Johnny Sauter, 150 championship points each, and they didn't have a lot to spare, I might add, because they got caught, they and their crews got caught using illegal wing mounts last weekend at the big old race in Charlotte. I'm sure one NASCAR fan or another will call us up and tell us what a wing mount is, but this sounds really this sounds extremely bad.
It surprises me because I wasn't aware that there were wings on NASCAR cars. This is a new development. Former tennis star and Paris resident Yannick Noah said this week that he has no problem with what his son, Chicago Bulls forward Joakim Noah, was arrested for on Sunday in Florida. I guess that's one difference between Paris and Gainesville.
Or as Yannick said, marijuana in his pocket? You can find that in my couch today, for God's sakes. This seemed to be a little bit overblown to me, too. Joakim got busted. For drinking a beer outside, and they found marijuana in his pocket. Yannick was a notorious party animal, admitted in a magazine almost 25 years ago that he did indeed involve himself in the ganja. And I'm not surprised that he's a bit blasé about this, even though, you know, sports radio in America is having a collective series of bovines about it.
Robbie Knievel, the son of Evel Knievel, made it over 24 trucks on his motorcycle last Saturday, though from what he said before the attempt, he may have doubted that he could do that. What was it exactly that he said?
He said, to the crowd, by the way, and not just to the folks hanging around, hopefully I'll see you after the jump. It's the kind of optimism that gets people going 95 miles an hour off a 200-foot ramp.
On Wednesday, 652 very limber people played the largest ever game of Twister. And am I correct in assuming that some participants came away with more than just satisfaction over a job well done?
Yeah, this was set up by a matchmaking website, datingdirect.com, and you had to be single to do it, thereby preventing us from having the great moment of some guy on the other side of the room going, "Hey, that's my wife with right hand on red over there. Don't you dare put left foot on green." Don't do it.
And finally, Charlie, Kevin Whitaker and Corey Jens set a new record for handshaking on Monday. They went into their endeavor with a high degree of confidence. Why was that?
I'd like to remind the listeners at home that they are listening to a sports program, and we will return to our regularly scheduled sports coverage in a moment.
New record.
We are now doing the world record for shaking hands.
Yes.
9.5 hours, beating the old record of whatever it was. I'm not going to look it up, and I don't care. But actually, Kevin Whitaker actually was the more honest thing of all. He said, "I looked up what some of the weakest records were, and I thought I could break this one." Good on you. Let me extend to you, in honor of the late Harvey Korman, who passed away this week, a Laurel and Hardy handshake.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. And I wish you could see us because we are shaking hands.
Thank you, Bill.
Charlie.
Give me back my watch now, please.
This weekend marks the start of the 39th World Series of Poker in Las Vegas. Over the next 6 weeks, more than 50,000 card players from nearly 90 countries will compete in 55 separate events, culminating in a 12-day no-limit Texas Hold'em tournament that costs $10,000 to enter and will have its final round televised live on ESPN. As Ron Schachter reports from Ledyard, Connecticut, there's a new learning resource for aspiring poker players who wish to proceed as directly as possible to the final table.
Early on a Saturday morning, the electronic slot machines at Foxwoods Casino are only starting to hum. But in a distant conference room, one group of gamblers has been hard at work for hours. With the open workbooks, PowerPoint presentations, and expert panel in front of the room, the gathering looks like any weekend business retreat. But the 60 attendees at this two-day seminar cluster around 8 regulation-sized felt-covered poker tables. The interactive screen overhead deals out demonstration hands, and the 3 instructors are all professional card players.
Now remember one thing, people. Never let the dealer count your money unless your opponent asks them to.
Welcome to the World Poker Tour Boot Camp. which for the past 4 years has been making the rounds of casinos from Oregon and Mississippi to New Jersey and Connecticut, and capitalizing on the national attention generated by the World Series of Poker and the omnipresent coverage of tournaments on TV. The master drill sergeant today is T.J. Cloutier, a WPT star who's been playing for almost 50 years and who got his start a little differently.
There wasn't any books to speak of, and there was none of these videos and boot camps and stuff. You learn by the seat of your pants is how you learned it when I played. You know, I mean, everybody pays their dues. That first few years, when I was 17 years old and I was playing low ball against the owner of Artichoke Joe's down in San Bruno, I mean, they took my paycheck like it was nothing, you know, but I learned.
The students with whom Cloutier is sharing his trade secrets, from how much to bet to how to behave at the table, include an accountant, psychiatrist, nurse practitioner, and New York City fireman. Hardly the same crowd he faced in San Bruno, California, a half century ago. Even fellow instructor Bernard Lee graduated from Harvard and worked 9 years at Boston Scientific before turning pro.
The best times for you to pay attention to other people's betting patterns or other people's bets, when? When you're not in the hand.
Yeah.
The easiest free information you can get.
And while today's gathering is part fantasy camp and part tennis camp, where recreational players can improve their game, WPT co-founder Ron Rubin says that's not the only possible outcome.
There are people that are taking the camp because poker is a hobby that they love to play twice a week and they want to be more successful at it. And there are examples of people that have taken this camp and become professional poker players or have won more money playing poker than they do at their jobs. So I think you get the casual player, you get the person that has the dream of, you know, fast track to the final table.
Gamblers, of course, and their balladeers have been dispensing advice for ages.
You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
But here, there's barely enough time to cover the lectures, laboratories, and evening tournaments, which can extend past midnight. The game of choice is Texas Hold'em. Each player gets 2 cards face down, and betting strategically along the way tries to build a winning hand from 5 shared cards flipped over by the dealer. Just as it is at any boot camp, discipline is the name of the game. The campers, who pay $1,700 for the privilege, soon discover when to fold 'em, which is a lot more often than they think. And Cloutier insists that when his students do bet, they keep the amount consistent all the time.
You might one time be bluffing, the next time you might have the holy city. So if you bet the same amount all the time, they got to figure it out. You're not telling them anything.
Retired engineer and teacher Patty Pearson, one of more than a dozen women in camp, ventured up from New Jersey. She'll be taking a stricter look at some of her poker practices.
Chasing straights, chasing flushes, which is strange for somebody with a master's in math ed, but I kind of know that the odds aren't great, and I just keep thinking, well, my luck is good, but I do it too much.
Most of the players here compete in Texas Hold'em tournaments, for which they pay a single entrance fee and try to finish in the money by making it to the final table. The campers put the theories into practice as they deal out hands while their instructors hover, telling them to keep their cards on the table and not to rattle their chips.
Let's put it this way. You played that hand about as bad as it can be played. because you call before the flop out of position, right?
Right.
But it's a good teaching tool.
While these campers figure on making back their tuition over time, Ira Schwartz, an accountant from Brooklyn, whose wife gave him this weekend as a birthday present, is aiming for a second career.
I devote approximately 40 to 50 hours a week for 9 months a year playing poker online, so that's why my wife thought it was appropriate for me to take a course and go to the next level.
Since Schwartz comes to the table with an actuarial edge, he's working on his people skills.
I'm trying to learn tells, like the different tells that people have as they sort of expose their hand without showing their hand, like their eye movements and their different types of body language, and that's what I'm trying to develop.
And then there's Frank Sieri, a funeral director from the Bronx who's only been playing Hold'em for 2 years.
Actually, what really brought me into this game was finding the World Poker Tour on television. It just turned me on. I watched the show for over a year before I played one hand of Hold'em, and then one day just ventured out into a small tournament and won it. It's been an amazing trip from there.
Sieri has already made a killing in his latest undertaking. The prize for that small tournament was the $10,000 entrance fee for the Foxwoods Poker Classic in April. He took home $103,000, but says there's more he needs to know.
Some of the things I learned today really pointed out to me, mm-hmm. Oh boy, did you make some mistakes. If I had taken this course before I made the final table at the World Poker Tour last month, I probably would have fared a lot better than fourth.
That would have been worth more than $200,000. For only a game, I'm Ron Schachter in Ledyard, Connecticut.
Guess what? Now you fall.
Look, be a lady tonight. Look, be a lady tonight. Look, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, look, be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentle.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jim Doyle, Kirk Carapeza, and from Bob Purdick at WHYY. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcast, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from the Dirty.com blogger Nick Ritchie and Friday Night Lights author Buzz Bissinger, who offer this thoughtful and reasoned give and take over the issue of sports blogs.
A dirty army, that's what the world has come to. A dirty army. How do I join?
Longtime arguers, last time callers. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Let's keep this party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby. I'm the fella you came in with. Luck, be a lady.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.